Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Face Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernacle. We have another episode in store for you today. Today is one more in the series of The Human Mormon Mind, where we delve into different topics in psychology and human behavior, often getting ideas from David McRaney's book, You Are Not So Smart, or You Are Now Less Dumb. If you haven't checked out those books, go check them out. They're pretty fun. It's all organized by topic. It's a lot of fun things that you'll learn about yourself and the things that you do. The topic for today is one I've had on my mind for over a year now. Anger. It is something that we all deal with, but I don't think that we tend to deal with it well. The word catharsis is often used in describing anger, or rather in describing the expulsion of anger, and it's this old idea where in order to get the bad out of our system, we would purge it out, kind of like letting off steam. But it turns out that letting off steam through yelling, venting our frustrations on our blogs or on our Facebook walls, or even displacing our anger through exercise or hitting a punching bag, does not fully expel our anger. In fact, according to research by Brad Bushman, who's interviewed in this discussion, in the long term, it might make us more angry or more aggressive. So I have that expert interview, as well as a stellar panel put together to discuss this topic. One of the panelists, LaShawn William Schultz, joins us halfway through, so you'll get a new voice popping up before we end. And this, for me, really provides a new way to think about the problem of anger and frustration. So with that, let's jump right to it. All right, so we have a great panel here today. We have Misha McGriggs, who's been our resident expert on the Human Mormon Mind series. Misha, why don't you reintroduce yourself and remind everyone who you are?
Sure. Thanks, Brian. I'm Misha McGriggs. I am a fourth-year psychology student at BYU, counseling psychology, and I'm happy to be here.
Great. And we also have Jeremy Timothy, who's been blogging at Rational Face for quite some time, and he was on the podcast, one of the very first ones that I'd concocted about moral psychology, using some of Jonathan Haidt's stuff to discuss that topic. He's back. So, Jeremy, could you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Jeremy Timothy. I am a pediatric neurologist in Mesa, Arizona, and a blogger at Rational Face.
All right. Great. So let's get started. Normally, Misha has done the last two episodes anyway. She's done our little mini lecture. But I was able to contact an expert on this topic in particular, and the topic is catharsis, or venting your anger. Brad Bushman at Ohio State University has made this his area of expertise, along with other things such as the effects of violent video games, things like that. So this is his area of expertise. I had a fun, quick little interview with him. So let's jump right to that to introduce our topic.
First, emotions can be grouped along two dimensions. One is whether the emotion is positive or negative, and the other is whether the emotion is highly arousing or not arousing. And anger is negative and arousing, and it's an approach motivation. People who are angry are motivated to do something. They don't like the unpleasant feeling, and actually, you know, many causes in throughout history were served well by anger, such as the women's rights movement, the civil rights movement, to name a couple. But normally people don't like to feel angry, and they want to get rid of it. And one common belief is that anger, you know, resides inside of you, and that if you don't vent your anger or blow off steam or get it off your chest, somehow you'll explode in an aggressive rage.
That's kind of the idea, that we've got to let things out. We've got to let off steam. We've got to just deal with this somehow, you know. And like you said, some movements really benefited from this motivating emotion, but in everyday life it's not necessarily the best thing to do all the time. So what are the ways that we deal with this? How do we express our anger through venting or catharsis?
Well, most people who vent their anger yell, they scream, they swear, that's doing it verbally, but they could also do it physically, such as pounding on a pillow or hitting a punching bag or kicking a trash can or pounding on a wall or breaking glass, things like that. So those are the most common ways that people vent their anger.
In raising our kids, one of the things that we read in a book somewhere was, if you have a child that gets upset and yells a lot, that, you know, tell them not to yell at their friends or yell at their sister or whatever, but to go punch a pillow or something like that, you know, to displace it somehow. But how effective are these venting modes, either through yelling or hitting a pillow or something like that? What has your research shown how effective this is?
Yeah, of course it's more effective to punch a pillow than to punch a person, but the critical question is whether you're more or less likely to punch a person after you've punched a pillow, and the answer is you're more likely to do that. You know, maybe you've heard the old joke, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? The answer is practice, practice, practice. Well, how do you become an angry, aggressive person? The answer is the same, practice, practice, practice. And people who vent their anger are basically practicing how to behave aggressively. They yell, they scream, they shout, they hit, they kick. They learn that when they become angry, they behave aggressively. Those are maladaptive responses. They're bad for the person because they can lead to coronary heart disease and other physical problems. But they're also bad for other people who are getting yelled at or screamed at. Our research shows that venting anger just makes people more angry and more aggressive rather than less angry and less aggressive.
You know, that it's just so strange to think of it that way, that it doesn't solve the problem, because in the moment, at least, it feels really good. It feels very satisfying. It seems intuitive that it feels good, and so it must be good. It must be helping solve this problem. Why is there this disconnect between what intuitively makes sense and what actually feels good in the experience, but the data seems to show that we're being misled by that intuition?
Yeah, actually, in our laboratory experiments, we ask people, after we've angered them and they've hit a punching bag, how good it feels, and people love it. They about 75-80% of people report that it does feel good. The problem is that this good feeling just reinforces aggressive behavior, and we found a positive relation between how good it feels and how aggressive people are after they vent their anger. You know, so maybe it feels good to take street drugs too, you know, or to eat chocolate all day. But just because something feels good doesn't mean it's a healthy thing to do.
So I guess we shouldn't use our feelings of satisfaction as moral guides or effectiveness guides necessarily, with the street jugs and chocolate as the example. That makes a lot of sense. One of the things that Bushman brought up at the very beginning of the interview is that anger is a very specific type of emotion, in that it's a negative emotion, but it's also an arousing emotion, which, as he gave an example, means it will push us to action. It will make us do something. And in some cases, that has served us well. It has served movements well, like the women's movement and other movements that have been propelled forward from feelings of anger and frustration. But let's talk about what arousing emotions are. What are they? What are they good for, and what are they not good for? So maybe Misha and then Jeremy.
So, I mean, essentially arousal, right, is a state of heightened activity in your brain and in your body. So an emotion that is going to be kind of connected or linked to some type of, most likely some type of physiological response or physiological change in your body. So, you know, the emotion of anxiety, let's say, that's an arousing emotion, right? You have this, sometimes if you're very anxious, you might have a galvanic skin response where your hands sweat or your pulse races or your heart is racing or your blood pressure is high. There might be a change in your body temperature. And anger is also one of those. So it would be in an emotion that elicits this response throughout your body, that lets you know that there's some chemical changes most likely going on in your brain.
So, Jeremy, do you have something more to offer from a neurological perspective on these arousing emotions?
Well, I mean, that was a pretty good description. It's an emotion that arouses your fight or flight response. So things like fear or anger or anything that will cause, you know, your heart to beat faster, your blood pressure to go up. And yeah, the whole idea is to get you to do something to motivate you. So,
okay. So what are some examples of where this can go wrong? You know, where, you know, one positive example would be defending someone that is being hurt. And so then you're angered by that, you know, by your child being bullied or being abused or something like that. You're brought to anger and you act on that and defend them. What are some ways where the result of this arousing emotion is not so positive? Let me give some examples that LaShawn... Okay, so LaShawn, in discussing this online, she said, anger also motivates latent senses of entitlement. Hence, the men's rights activists and father's rights activists and domestic violence deaths, etc. You know, there's the positive thing of bringing about equality, social justice, anger driving those activities. But it's not an emotion that we can rely on, I guess is the point. And the reason I bring that up about the emotion that you rely on is that, you know, in the rational faith world, we talk about this faith crisis or social justice themes quite a bit. Someone's being oppressed or they've gone through some sort of psychological trauma of different degrees, you know, depending on the individual and the situation. And according to the Kubler-Ross model, that anger something that's going to happen, and it's something that should be expected, and some might argue that it's something that you have to go through, and so we should maybe embrace it, or at least not reject it and not suppress it. That's one response to anger, is just suppressing it. But it seems from Bushman's work and other things that's simply not going to be a long-term solution to it. It's not going to resolve the issue by suppression. And so we have these other ways of venting.
I mean, I would agree that venting is helpful. And while we know that anger doesn't always lead to aggression, aggression is most often preceded by anger. And so there's definitely a relationship between the two. And so if we're often angry and we stay in that place, then there could be some, you know, aggressive behavior or actions that maybe aren't the most productive or the most helpful. And so I think staying in the anger, you know, isn't very sustainable for long-term mental health.
I mean, anger leads you to do things that are often ill-advised, like lashing out at someone, attacking them verbally, or worse, physically. I mean, all assaults probably come from anger, and those are things that in a social situation aren't necessarily a good thing.
To quote Yoda,
fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
So what more needs to be said? But, you know, the thing that's confusing about it, at least intuitively, is that it feels so good to get the, you know, we have all these expressions and these metaphors that are just part of our language, like get it out of your system. You know, I just need to vent. You know, you need to deal with it. And we have these ways that seem like, yeah, that's what you have to do. And as I mentioned in the interview, we had read in a book or got advice from someone somewhere, you know, if you have a child that's overly angry, instead of letting them yell or, you know, letting them start to be violent or just build up this frustration by stuffing it in, having them hit a pillow, something like that to displace the anger. But according to Bushman's research, that doesn't help. The hitting the pillow thing does not actually dissipate the anger. So we have this confusing sense of satisfaction in the moment, but in the long term, it's actually not helping us reduce our aggressive behavior. The thing that intuitively and culturally is telling us is the solution is actually not the solution.
So Bushman references, I was looking through the references really quickly on that article, and he references Albert Ellis, who's one of the theorists that I really respect. And he, you know, Albert Ellis put anger in the category of a self-defeating emotion, in that it does not promote psychological well-being and it doesn't normally end at any outcome that's helpful or sustainable. And so his work was in kind of helping with anger, was that if we could move to a place of like annoyance or frustration, you can still have some negative emotions for, you know, an unfortunate situation, but that anger is one that's going to kind of be defeating to you in the end, and it isn't really going to help you make any productive decisions in your life. And so if you can replace that anger with something like a frustration or annoyance, it's not saying be happy about every situation, but kind of anger isn't it probably won't help you in the long term. So
if you can put yourself into a distance, like if you can distance yourself from what's causing you anger, it seems like you're saying that puts you in a position to make choices that are going to be more productive in the long term, where it's more difficult to make the productive long-term choices in an angry state.
Right. And that doesn't even have to just be, you know, proximity or physically putting yourself at a distance. It could be, but it could also be done cognitively and mentally.
Right, yeah, psychological distance.
Putting yourself at a distance and kind of, you know, breaking down your thought patterns and seeing which ones are distortions and where you could, you know, replace, you know, dispute and replace those with something a little more productive.
Before we get to the solutions, let's just list a couple ways that you've noticed either in yourself or, you know, Misha, you've had a lot of experience in your clinical rotations. You've met with a lot of people. I'm assuming some of them have had anger issues of different degrees. What are some of the ways that you've noticed either in yourself or in people around you, maybe online since we're a blog? What are some ways that people have gotten trapped in this vicious cycle, if you will?
I think that one of the things that gets you trapped is really believing that it is justified and that you should be angry about something or at someone. And that belief in that it's, you know, it's justified, really keeps people in that place. Like, I have the right to be angry. And certainly you have that right. But anger, you know, anger, especially that isn't, if you don't aggress against anyone, say it is in an online forum, right? That anger that you have is really who it's impacting the most is you. You're sitting on your side of the screen, very upset, having this arousing emotion and getting yourself, you know, hot and bothered and upset. And, but I think that the believing that you're justified in it, and this is just what you're supposed to do when someone, you know, disrespects you or is unjust to you, I think that is one thing that really keeps people stuck.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One thing that I've seen people express explicitly along those lines is they're trying to, like the letter that they might send out, explaining why they're leaving the church or whatever the situation is, but they'll say something like, I want them to feel what I've felt, because going through a faith crisis is often not a happy experience. It can be incredibly painful, and so you want other people to know what you've gone through, and so you would write something, you know, very vicious, maybe, from the desire of having other people really get you and understand where you're coming from. Jeremy, what have you seen or observed?
Well, you know, there comes a place where anger can help. Say if you're deeply depressed, you don't have any motivation to do anything. And that's, I don't know, on a personal note, that's something I've gone through before. And I was in a situation that felt deeply unfair, and anger was something that got me moving. But after it got me moving, it started being counterproductive. So, because addressing injustice, it doesn't always work to lash out at people who are in a position to fix it or change it, because then they just get defensive.
That makes a lot of sense. So I read in Haidt's first kind of popular book, The Happiness Hypothesis, because he talked about this, that catharsis, he was talking about people overcoming trauma, and there's this kind of myth about catharsis helping people let off steam, but it doesn't really work. So Jonathan Haidt referenced a book by Carol Tavris. The one book that she's more famous for that I've seen referenced anyway is called Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me. But she has another book called Anger, The Misunderstood Emotion. And I dug that up and looked through it. And I have a couple notes here, and it says, aggression is cathartic when directed at a peer, not when directed towards a superior. And for men, aggression is cathartic. For women, friendliness is cathartic, likely due to culturally defined gender roles, and it's also been shown that role reversal can be learned, so it's not a universal thing. In the long run, you do not reduce your anger. You learn what to do when you get angry, whether that means becoming aggressive, writing letters, listening to music, or forgiving. You just train yourself. Whatever you do, you get better at doing that. And aggression in solving a problem, aggression often has the opposite effect. Rather than reducing or exercising the anger, it inflames it. And even ruminating or acting out a pseudo-confrontation also further inflames anger and frustration. And an angry tirade against someone can be cathartic if directed at the offender, and if the offender does not respond, which is highly unlikely. So you could, there was somewhere else just in my memory that venting anger at a subordinate also works, because when you're in a superior position, you can actually make the changes happen because you have control, or at least a greater degree of control. But shouting at someone that either has control to, that's going to react negatively from your display of emotion, or shouting at an institution that's not going to hear you, and therefore it's not going to adjust itself based on your ranting and raving. It really, it's just you talking to yourself and getting your blood boiled. It doesn't actually produce any meaningful change. So there's that. So, yeah, we've talked about anger quite a bit. Let's go back to the interview with Dr. Bushman and talk about what to do. What are the, besides venting, besides stuffing it in, besides yelling, what is it that we can do?
Yeah, well, people often use the analogy of a steam cooker on a stove, right? And they assume that, well, if the pressure is building up inside the steam cooker, you really have only two options. One is to try to stuff it inside, in which case the steam pressure will explode. The other is to vent the steam. But a much better option is just to turn the heat down. And people forget there's a third option. Stuffing it inside is not good for your health either. Venting it outwardly is not good for your health, but it's bad for others. So that's even worse. So scientific research has shown that at least six things do work for managing anger. Of course, if you have a chronic anger problem, you need to seek professional help. So these are suggestions more like for daily hassles that people experience. You know, one is a delay, such as counting to 10 before you say or do anything. Maybe your grandmother told you to do that. Thomas Jefferson said if you're really angry, you should count to 100 instead. And the reason this works is because angry people are highly aroused. And as time passes, the arousal dissipates, so the anger goes away. A second approach is relaxation. You can try to reduce the arousal, such as by taking deep breaths or listening to calming music or doing deep muscle techniques. But this works for the same reason, because it reduces the arousal. A third technique is distraction. Angry people tend to ruminate about whatever it is that made them angry. So one effective technique is to think about something else instead, such as working on a crossword puzzle or reading a nonviolent book or taking a walk or just get your mind off the anger-provoking situation. Fourth technique is to do something incompatible with anger and aggression. This is highly effective, such as petting a puppy or helping somebody in need, or watching a nonviolent comedy, or kissing your lover. And the reason these techniques work is because it's impossible to experience anger and these incompatible emotions at the same time. So the idea here is to drive out anger with an emotion that's incompatible with anger, such as empathy. The fifth one is self-distancing. Like I mentioned before, anger is an approach motivation. So angry people tend to approach situations. They want to solve the situation. So one effective technique, and we've shown this in our own research, is to step back from the anger-provoking situation. View yourself from a more distant third-person perspective, as if you were an outside observer. Adopt a fly-on-the-wall perspective, if you will. This is easy to do, and it works. If you just tell people who are angry, try to step back and view yourself as if you were an outside observer. People are less immersed in the anger-provoking situation. And finally, don't get hangry. Maybe you've heard that term, hangry. It comes from hungry plus angry. Our brain is only about 2% of our body weight, but it uses 20 to 30% of the calories we consume. So our brain is a very demanding organ, and the part of our brain just behind our forehead is called the prefrontal cortex. And that's the part of our brain that's in charge of executive functions. And one of those functions is controlling our emotions. And the emotion that people have the most difficulty controlling is anger. So our brain needs fuel to control our emotions, including and especially anger. And it gets that fuel from the foods that we eat. So we should focus on eating healthy foods such as veggies and whole grains, because those types of foods give our brain the calories it needs to exercise control over angry feelings.
Those are great examples, and it makes a lot of sense. A lot of them, even though they're all distinct, well, I think the hangry one is definitely distinct from the others, but the more action-oriented ones, they all seem to be some sort of distraction that either makes you think about something else, feel something else, or just like the distance one is just separating yourself. it made me think of a quote I read somewhere. It might have been in Catherine Schulz's book, Being Wrong, that many things when viewed as an outsider, things that are drama as an insider, turn into a comedy as an outsider, just by giving yourself some distance.
Yeah, that seems consistent with the research we've conducted on self-distancing.
Thank you very much, Brad Bushman, for coming onto the podcast and offering your expertise. And we'll make sure to link to your TED Talk and some other interesting things from your faculty webpage. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
So I think earlier we've kind of talked at the idea of displacing yourself, distancing yourself from what's causing you anger, not physically or geographically, but cognitively, psychologically distancing yourself. But the one that he listed that I found most interesting is doing something that is incompatible with anger. And in his Psychology Today article, he says, for example, petting a puppy, watching a comedy, making love, or performing a good deed can help, because those acts are incompatible with anger, and therefore they make the angry state impossible to sustain. So I would like you guys to respond to that. Like, how does this is kind of new for me. Like, there's certain, it kind of intuitively makes sense, but what is the mechanism that causes certain states to be impossible to sustain simultaneously?
Well, I'm not sure about that, the last little part, but I do know that in dialectical behavior therapy, one of the things that is a big skill in DBT, opposite action is something that is a skill that's taught to patients in DBT. And basically, it would be like if you are angry, you would do the exact opposite thing. So if you are angry with someone, and an example of an opposite action would be to serve them, which seems so like cliche and Mormon, right? But but actually doing that good deed that was mentioned, that can actually, you know, help to dissipate that feeling of anger. Now, it's important that you do it, what they say in DBT is all the way. So if you don't commit, right, with your whole mind and your whole everything to the opposite action, you'll actually feel angrier. So if you were to, you know, purchase something for somebody and you're still angry with them when you give it to them, you might end up like, you know, chucking it at their head. And that wouldn't be, you know, helpful. But if you were to really say, you know what, no, I really want to buy this for them because I think that it will help me dissipate my anger. So let me think about what is their favorite thing and won't that make them, you know, whatever. That'll put them in a better mood and then we will be in a better place. So opposite action is kind of the way that you can go about doing, you know, doing that opposite thing, the thing that is incongruent with the anger.
So part of the therapy isn't going to the pet store and holding a kitten?
You know, I mean, therapy animals are helpful, for sure.
That sounds pretty sweet.
You know, anger, it works on a positive feedback loop. You release adrenaline, which then works on the brain to continue to stoke the anger. And it makes sense that you do something to short-circuit it. You activate some other loop, particularly one that's calming, and yeah, it's going to shut off the response.
And now showing up after the halftime show, we have LaShawn Williams-Schultz.
My name is LaShawn Williams-Schultz. I am a mental health therapist in Utah, and I'm also an adjunct faculty member at the community college. I'm a doctoral student finishing my doctorate in education this fall.
Great. All right, so you've missed us talking about how anger is a negative emotion, and I actually quoted you from some of the things you mentioned in our online discussion, how it can not just promote good social justice causes, but can promote the ones that we would all probably disagree with, men's rights things and stuff like that. So we've kind of covered all of that ground, and we're more on the dealing with it, managing it, dissipating it. And Misha just talked about, what was it, dialectical behavioral therapy?
Distress tolerance, yes.
Okay. What are some examples or other ways that you've either used in your experience as a therapist, counselor, or in yourself, or just observed that are effective in dissipating anger?
For me personally and professionally, one of the really cool things about being a therapist is so much of what you teach are things that you've gone through and experienced and seen that they've worked. I have some highly sensitive, highly emotional children, and understanding the way that the brain works has been instrumental in how I parent. One of the techniques that you can use when a child is angry, number one, is understanding that it's all right brain, emotional, abstract activity that's fueling the internal automatic nervous system, this fight or flight response. That's really where anger kind of comes from, is this response that you're in the sense of danger. And so that sparks fear. And before fear can really take hold, the response to defend, attack, and protect yourself is what comes up. So that's what anger is. And with kiddos, when they get dysregulated emotionally, the key for us as parents is to find ways to help them regulate themselves emotionally and soothe themselves. And one of the biggest things to do there is physical touch. And with my kiddo that's pretty highly sensitive and highly emotional, I went from attempting timeouts and other punitive discipline strategies to using a time in, and it cut her meltdowns from minutes, 15, 30 minutes, 45 minutes off and on to 45 seconds just by asking her to come and sit in mommy's lap and snuggle with me. So personally, if I hadn't seen it work, I don't think I would believe it. But it's really about getting to that calm, safe place. That, I mean, that sense of safety is huge, because if you think about it, that saber-toothed tiger fight or flight response, you want safety emotionally and physically. So when you're angry, it's the same kind of thing. You want physical and emotional safety. And that's why being able to actually physically touch someone that helps soothe and regulate you, that's something that works for kids just as much as adults, because this is how we attach and connect to one another so that we can kind of stay in this place together and then do hard work that comes from what we're angry about, what we want to see changed, and it allows us to actually develop those ideas.
Excellent. That I'm going to write that one down.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's great. That's exactly right, I think, in your description of the fight or flight response. You're not wanting to start a fight necessarily. You just want to be, you want all the problems to be gone and taken care
of. You do. Like, it's...
But that sounds like in my experience with my kids, that sounds like a tricky thing, because, you know, sometimes when they get upset, they're physically rigid and they don't touch me, say things like that. Mm-hmm. So, in your experience, how do you tame the beast so that you can soothe them?
You tame the beast by realizing that don't touch me still means I want to get the problem solved, and I'm so scared that if you touch me, something bad might happen. And so we're still working to do that emotional regulation work by talking and soothing. And even if you can't hold them and hug them, even touching the shoulder or rubbing the back or even just closing the distance physically and increasing the proximity that you have to the little one, and talking with them, then just being close, being at their level, being, you know, kneeling down or sitting near them or just sitting next to them. And if they'll let you just touch them, that's the part that still starts the process of emotionally regulating them. So the right brain calms down and then the left brain is able to make the connection and start talking about why we're so upset. Because use your words does not work if I'm kicking and screaming. I have to stop kicking and screaming before my right brain will calm down enough that my left brain can kick in and tell you the story of why I'm kicking and screaming.
Ah, okay. This is good stuff.
If I could, I'd like to kind of give the adult version too, which I think is where we started off this question.
Yes.
Therapeutically, I use a lot of acceptance and commitment therapy, which has its roots in some connection with dialectical behavior therapy. And really what it allows you to do, it's not some of the thought distraction and go do something different that Bushman speaks of, but it's about noticing that you're angry. And that's that piece about being mindful and allowing yourself to say, okay, I notice that I'm angry. figuring out where the anger starts in your body, identifying that place, whether it, and how does it feel? Is it hot? Is it prickly? Is it tingly? Is it tight? What is the actual physical sensation that comes in with this feeling of anger? Breathing into that, becoming mindful, and then really having this conversation with yourself. So kind of that self-distancing thing that Bushman talks about, being able to talk to yourself and validate and be compassionate with yourself and say, yeah, I am angry. And of course, it would make sense that I'm angry because of this incident or this event happening. And I'm angry about it because I feel this way. You learn so much more about yourself and primary emotions and secondary emotions. And then if I know my primary emotion is anger, primary is what you feel first. My secondary emotion is sadness or fear. Secondary is what you feel the most. And you can't get to that secondary level of emotion without slowing yourself down, tuning into the physical sensations in your body, validating the fact that you do feel anger, and figuring out what's underneath the anger, sadness, fear, anxiety, feeling alone. And when you do that, acceptance and commitment therapy says accept how you feel, and then you commit to what you value in life. So there are a number of values that you say are important to you. And so I value authenticity. So even though I'm angry and it comes from this place of sadness, I value authenticity. So I'm going to commit to this value of authenticity, and then you take action. And I'm going to take the action of speaking up because I was cut off, or speaking up because I was disrespected, or speaking up because I value authenticity. And in order to live in accordance and in integrity with that value, I'm going to use my anger to help me stay in alignment with that value, and I'm going to take action to speak up and say what I need to say in a respectful way so that I can properly honor and address my angry feelings.
Perfect. That's good stuff. Jeremy, before we move on, I just want to see if you have any other thoughts or examples on this topic of how we, ways that you've seen in yourself or observed others in dealing with anger or frustration effectively.
Well, I liked that last part about how using your anger constructively, if you do see an injustice, you can use it as a factor of action to address that injustice. And that's why it's an activating emotion. And that is probably the constructive way to use it. But as far as diffusing it, I think we've covered that pretty thoroughly. But yeah, I think it's important to emphasize that, you know, we have anger for a reason, and it can be used constructively.
One of the ways that I've read in different places as advice in dealing with anger, or more specifically dealing in trauma or a big change in life, is writing. A lot of people suggest, you know, keeping a journal, writing your thoughts out, writing your emotions out. And on that subject, in reading Jonathan Haidt's The Happiness Hypothesis, he addressed some of the research in this area. And blowing off steam while you're writing simply won't do. And this researcher, Pennebaker, discovered that it's not about steam, it's about sense-making. The people in his studies who used their writing time to vent got no benefit. The people who showed deep insight into the causes and consequences of the event on their first day of writing got no benefit either. They had already made sense of things. It was the people who made progress across the 4 days who showed increasing insight. They were the ones whose health improved over the next year. In later studies, Pennebaker asked people to dance or sing to express their emotions, but these emotionally expressive activities gave no health benefit. You have to use words, and the words have to help you create a meaningful story. If you can write such a story, you can reap benefits of reappraisal, one of the two healthy coping styles, even years after an event. You can close a chapter of your life that was still open, still affecting your thoughts and preventing you from moving on with the larger narrative. So, with that little bit in mind, why is it that writing or using words, as he says here, seems to be more therapeutic than dancing or singing or just doing other things. What is so special about writing in your mind that makes it useful?
Writing gets at the root cause. You can break down the big why and understand where something's coming from rather than letting it rule you. You know where the root of everything is and can address it. And just understanding, there's power in that.
So writing hasn't been something that I have worked with clients, but it is something that, you know, I thought a little bit about, and I think that there's something to writing that can create like a mind-body-spirit connection almost, so that, I mean, your hand is putting, you know, your hand is writing, it's holding the pen, and it's writing down kind of the thoughts that are coming out of your brain, and maybe the things that are on your heart. And so everything in that moment is kind of connected. Your body is engaged with your mind, and your mind is engaged, you know, with your emotions. And so I think that there could be, I think there's potential for catharsis and powerful healing through that. That act.
And so I'm going to add in not devil's advocate, but just some different layers to help us understand the benefits of writing, and also not completely dismissing music and physical expression, because I think emotional release is emotional release. So first, in support of writing, sometimes even just mindless writing. If you ever read the book called The Artist's Way, one of the assignments in The Artist's Way is to get up and to write what are called morning pages. And it is simply the first things that come to your mind right when you wake up in the morning. And she says it doesn't matter how long it takes you, but you have to write 3 pages longhand. And this is just to get you in the habit of brain dumping. For a lot of folks, particularly folks who are more introverted, who tend to live inside of their heads and can have an entire conversation and can remember and can ruminate and perseverate over conversations or failed connections or disappointments that have happened verbally, it's really, really good for introverted folks to have a place to be able to dump, because introverted people are not ones to dump and to respond reactively right when something is happening. And in this brain dumping, it's not coherent. You're not writing with a purpose. You're just writing to get everything out of your brain. Colleagues and I who have talked and who have actually used this method, some of us will find that we just start with saying what's in front of us, you know, up, green, window, light, wood, whatever it might be. And then your brain starts getting some coherency. And then it starts going through and processing whatever is in your mind. And by the time you get to page 3, you stop, even if you don't want to. So you do these 3 pages after a while, and what happens is you start working through and processing the emotions that are coming out while you're writing. And it's not anything that you go back and read through, but you just start having this internal conversation with yourself and answering and asking and being compassionate. And it makes your mind stop, it makes it stop rambling and makes it stop running, because you have to have time to actually form the thoughts and form the words and put them to paper for 3 long-handed pages. Second, on the flip side about why might writing be more beneficial than physical expression, I have friends and colleagues who writing and talking things through doesn't work for them if they don't have language. There are a lot of folks that get frozen trying to explain themselves. Again, this is because the right brain and the emotions are so worked up that instead of talking, they will run. And after they've run, they can come back and talk to you. Or they will, you know, rollerblade. And after they've rollerbladed, you know, 10 miles, they can come back and talk to you. There's a documentary called Rise, and it focuses on African-American youth in the inner city of Los Angeles and how they use a dance style called crumping as emotional release. And there's a scene in the documentary where one of the younger girls who comes from a traumatic background is using crumping and dance to physically express what she doesn't have words to explain. And there's a moment where they say she broke. and it's just an emotional, physical release where she finishes dancing and she collapses on the ground and is carried out of the circle because she needed the dance to get out all of the energy, all of the emotion, all of the trauma and negativity that she was working through. It had to come through dance first. And I think if we can balance this, class privilege thing that we have about writing, because if some folks don't have a grasp of language, then that's going to make them feel more intimidated. It's going to introduce more shame, and they're going to feel like, well, I can't work through my issues if I can't write them out. Using dance as a method or physical exercise and activity as a method to give them permission for the language to actually come is actually really beneficial too. So I wouldn't say rule out the physical activity, but maybe use it as a springboard eventually to write or to draw. Because writing can also lead to folks to do what we call intellectualizing, is they still go right back up into their head and they start pontificating and philosophizing about how all these things are happening, and it still gives them a chance to disconnect from the lived physical experience of emotion.
Oh, I'm glad you rounded that out, because I was just gonna praise writing. But yeah, I think it's good to realize that people have different needs, and we're not all stamped out of the same cookie cutter mold. So we're going to respond differently. But I would think that the dancing or the exercising wouldn't be like, I'm pissed off, so I'm going to dance it out, or I'm going to go lift some weights, or I'm going to go run. It would be more directed or more, I guess, thoughtful than just moving your body around in response to this arousing emotion. Because that seemed to be one of the things that Bushman, I don't know if he had done the research or he was just citing it, was that exercise wasn't as effective. It increased the aggression over time rather than dissipating it.
Well, I would rather not pet my dog when I'm angry. I don't have a dog. I have a cat. So I'd rather not pet my cat when I'm angry if I haven't done something. So he says, you know, you can't do something that's a totally opposite emotion and still feel angry.
Yeah,
I can angrily pet my cat, which means we're probably going to be hitting it. You know what I mean?
Pet the crap out of
it. You can pet the crap out. It's like,
be careful, you're
going to
strangle
lover.
It.
You could. And, you know, go kiss your lover. Well, if your lover is the person that you're angry at, that's the last person you're going to want to go kiss in the moment, because it's not that easy. Now, for anyone who says, you know, dancing should be more purposeful, one of the things that we also have to add into it is the choice of music. So if you get angry music and you get something that is, you know, some really heavy metal or some really angry guitars or really angry rap music, or if you get blues or jazz or just slow country or bluegrass, there is so much emotion that can come from the human body when the person connects with the music, because the music and the dance can communicate beyond words. And it may just be because my background is as a dancer. I've seen people dance to a Seal song and not be able to make it through because the words and the power and what the song and the dance mean to them, those things come together and become a very, very powerful emotional expression. So my bias and default as a dancer is totally saying don't ever rule dancing out, because you can really work through some stuff that you don't have words for. You just have feeling and emotion.
Well, and again, right, so in DBT, an important, right, if you're going to do opposite action, you know, doing it all the way, if you do it only halfway or you're not really committed, then it could actually make the anger worse and
more
so,
repressed.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think your example of throwing the gift across the table is perfect. It's like, well, there you go.
Right. So if you can't get in a headspace or an emotional place, and I think mindfulness can help with that, where you really are feeling, you know, the opposite, you know, way, and you're doing the opposite action in that way, then I think it'll go over a lot better than if you do it only, you know, halfway or.
In dancing, we call that full out.
Yes.
It's interesting when we're talking about these kind of artistic ways of processing anger. They're all kind of meditative, that you're going within this place yourself to kind of try and understand the feeling. And drawing is one that's real effective in kids when they're trying to work through a trauma. But writing, basically, I like that brain dumping. That's almost like you're just, whatever you're experiencing, you're just process, well, like you would meditation, where you just let things wash over you.
Absolutely.
The thing that made me think about writing, maybe I should have prefaced the whole thing with this, was that now a lot of these conversations are, well, I don't know if they occurred before, but now they are occurring through Facebook or other mediums where people are writing out their thoughts or their emotions and often venting through the written word. And to me, writing seems powerful just from my experience in going to school. When I would sit through a lecture and just listen to it, I wouldn't be able to remember or retain things very well. But something through the physical act of writing, I'm able to kind of anchor that stuff into my brain a little bit better. And the bit that I shared, to me, makes a lot of sense, because you're not just the ones that got therapeutic benefit out of it weren't just writing out and expressing their anger, but they were kind of writing their own life story and taking that frustration and kind of directing themselves to re-narrating their life in a way that wasn't just an expression of the anger, but it was moving forward and moving on from it, which seems convincing to me. But I don't know.
Narrative therapy. That's exactly what that is. Narrative therapy.
Oh, okay.
You externalize the story and externalize the trauma, and you allow folks to actually write the story. And so that gives them, when you're externalizing it, it allows you to give that personal and emotional distance to yourself. And it gives you permission to write the story out and then to rewrite it, whether that means you change the main characters, you add in a different plot or a different storyline. It's very, very powerful to use narrative therapy and allow people to kind of take control of their story. I had a client that was a creative type, and it ended up being, you know, rework this in your creative element and see what comes up. And you can see so much of the projection of the client's experiences onto some of the main characters, even though it was a completely unrelated creative project. It's really neat, very empowering, and very real.
In summary, Bushman listed several different methods, not just one, to deal with or manage the anger. So don't think there's just one way. And even the things that might be compelling to someone like me or other people that might be writing these books, like writing, that doesn't mean it works for everybody. As LaShawn mentioned, others are going to express themselves in a very different way that makes sense to them. That's a way that they can narrate their life through their body. This has really shaped things for me as I've read it, helped me understand more about the emotion of anger and how to deal with it, because it's not going away anytime soon. I figure I'm going to be disappointed and upset at different times throughout my life. But I find this discussion and this subject very useful, because I like having ways, concrete ways to deal with it and deal with my emotions rather than stew on them. So I'll just say thanks for Misha, Jeremy, and LaShawn. LaShawn coming in on the second half and contributing and participating in this discussion. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, hey, there you go. Why don't you let us know how you deal with anger and frustration and whether it has been working for you or not? Feel free to leave a comment on the blog. And while you're at it, jump over to iTunes and leave a review and a rating for the podcast. As for next week, we'll be getting a very compressed version of conference out to you. So those that can't listen or watch all the many hours of conference, we'll do it for you. Consider it conference by proxy. So you have that to look forward to. And until next time, keep keeping it weird.